of God's jealousy. Such, then, are the tales of Jacob, written in the mien of the grey-haired man, as they passed before his swimming gaze, that got entangled in his eyebrows when he fell into his solemn musing, either alone or with other people, and his look gave them a start, so that they nudged each other and whispered, "Hush, Jacob is thinking of his stories." Many of them I have already told and put in their proper light, even some which lie further ahead in point of time, such as Jacob's return to the West and the events thereafter. But 17 years, rich with incidents and episodes, remain to be filled in. Of these, the most important being Jacob's double wedding with Leah and Rachel, and the birth of Reuben. But Reuben was Leah's, and not Rachel's. Leah bore to Jacob his first son, who later trifled away his birthright, being like water for instability. It was not Rachel who conceived and bore him. The bride of Jacob's affection did not present to her lord this child, nor, according to the will of God, Simeon, Levi, Dan, or Judah, or any of the 10 ending with Zebulun, although at the end of the wedding feast, after Jacob had left Leah on the 5th day, and somewhat refreshed himself by going bird-shooting with the company, Rachel was brought in unto him, upon which event I will not further dwell, for I have already told how Jacob received Rachel. As the result of Laban's chicanery, he first received her in Leah, and it was in fact a double wedding that was held, the marriage with 2 sisters, one of whom he actually married, but the other in intent. And in this sense, what do we mean by actually? For from this point of view, Reuben was, after all, Rachel's son, conceived by union with her. And yet she that was so ready and willing went empty away, and Leah rounded apace and folded her hands in contentment over her burden, with her head meekly on one side and her lids dropped to hide her squint. She was delivered on the bricks and displayed great talent. It was a matter of a couple of hours, perfect child's play. Reuben shot out like a stream of water, and when Jacob, being hastily summoned, came in from the field, for it was the time of the sesame harvest, the infant was already bathed, rubbed off with salt, and wrapped up in swaddling bands. He put his hand upon him, and in the presence of all the household he said, "My son." Laban made a congratulatory speech. He adjured Jacob to be as untiring as himself, to add a new name 3 years running to his credit. And the newly delivered cried out joyfully from her bed across the court, 12 years running, without pause, she would be fruitful. Rachel heard it. Rachel could not be got to leave the cradle. It hung from the ceiling by cords, so that Leah could guide it with her hand. Rachel sat at the other side and looked at the child. When it cried, she got up and gave it to her sister, who put it to her swelling, milk-veined breast. Looked on greedily as it suckled, growing red and steamy with satisfaction, and watching pressed her hands against her own delicate bosom. "Poor little one," Leah would say to her, "fret not thyself. Thy turn will come, and thy prospects are far better than mine, for it is thee upon whom the master's eyes are turned, and for once that he cometh to me, there are 4 or 6 times that he is with thee. Then how canst thou fail?" But whatever the prospects for Rachel, it was Leah by God's will in whom they were fulfilled. For scarcely was she about, than she was again expectant, and went carrying Reuben upon her back, and Simeon in her belly, and felt hardly sick as he began to wax, and found it no matter for sighing that he made her greatly misshapen, but was sturdy and of good cheer up till the end, and worked in Laban's fruit garden until her hour came, and her face changed, and she gave order for the bricks to be set up. Then came forth Simeon with the greatest ease, and sneezed. He was admired of all, and most by Rachel, and what anguish it gave her to admire him. For the matter stood a little differently this time, indeed. Consciously and undeceived, Jacob had begot him upon Leah. He was hers entirely, and beyond a doubt. And Rachel, how was it with the little one? How blithely and earnestly she had looked in her cousin's eyes! With what courage and loving readiness for life! How confidently she had hoped and felt that she would bring forth to him children in both their likenesses, even sometimes twins! And now she went empty away, while Leah rocked her second-born. How came this about? The letter of the tradition is all we have when we seek to explain this melancholy fact. Briefly it says, "And when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." Just for that reason. It is an attempt at explanation, as good as another, a hypothesis, for we have no direct and authentic utterance of El Shaddai as to the meaning of this decree, and doubtless one never existed. It would be proper, however, to reject the interpretation if I knew a better one. But since I do not, I prefer to consider this one as essentially correct. The kernel of it is that God's dispensation was not primarily directed against Rachel, nor in Leah's favor. Rather, it constituted a discipline and an admonishment for Jacob himself, who, that is, was therein instructed that the soft and sentimental sovereignty he permitted to his feelings, the arrogance with which he cherished and promulgated them, were looked upon by Elohim with much disfavor, notwithstanding that this very tendency to selection and unbridled indulgence in arbitrary favoritism, this pride of feeling which would not submit itself to judgment, but rather required all the world to take it at its own valuation, might be referred back to a higher prototype, of which it was, in fact, the mortal counterpart. Do I say, although? Precisely because Jacob's glorification of his feelings was a duplicate of the other, it was punished. Anyone undertaking to speak on this point must take heed to his words. But even after the most scrupulous examination of the words I have quoted, there is no doubt that the motive power of the measure was God's jealousy of a privilege which, as he sought to make clear by this humiliation of Jacob's feeling, he regarded as his sole prerogative. I may be blamed for this interpretation, and it will hardly escape the objection that so petty and passionate a motive as jealousy is inapplicable as an explanation of divine decrees, but those who feel the offensiveness of the interpretation are free to regard the decree as a relic, spiritually unabsorbed, of earlier and less disciplined stages in the development of the divine essence, primitive manifestations upon which I have earlier sought to cast some light. I mentioned, for instance, the facial type of Yahu, warrior and weather control, lord of a swarthy troop of sons of the desert who called themselves his soldiers, which displayed harsh and violent traits as distinct from any holy ones whatever. The bond of God with the human spirit active in Abram was a bond for the purpose of mutual sanctification, a bond in which human and divine necessity were so mingled that one can scarcely say from which side, human or divine, the original impulse went out, but a bond in any case the existence of which betrays that the sanctification of God and that of man represent a dual process, in which both are most intimately bound up. Else, one might ask, why a bond? God's command to men, "Be holy, even as I am holy," already assumes the sanctification of God in man. It really means, "Let me become sanctified in thee, and be thou also sanctified." In other words, the purification of God from the gloomy and violent deity into the sanctified one, includes, if we work it backwards, that of man too, in whom it is consummated by God's urgent wish. This inward link, however, between the two situations, and the facts that God only attains his true dignity by the aid of the human spirit, and that man, on the other hand, only becomes worthy by contemplation of the actuality of God and its reference to himself, precisely this highly connubial combination and reciprocity of relations, sealed in the flesh and vouched for by the ring of circumcision, makes it understandable that precisely jealousy, as a survival of God's passionate and unsanctified stage, has remained longest with him, either as jealousy of idols, or perhaps of his prior right and prerogative of extravagant feeling, which is at bottom the same thing. For what was that uncontrolled feeling of one human being for another, which Jacob permitted himself for Rachel, and later, perhaps even intensifiedly, for her firstborn, but idolatry? Jacob's experiences with Laban may still in part be rightly understood as a just retribution for Esau's sufferings and fate, as a squaring of accounts with him in whose favor the balance had inequitably been weighed down. But on the other hand, when one considers Rachel's sad destiny, and after that remembers all that young Joseph had to bear, so that it was only by exceeding shrewdness and adroitness in his dealings with God and man that he managed to give things a turn to the good at last, one feels convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that what we are dealing with is jealousy of the purest water, and in the most literal sense, not merely general and with respect to a prerogative, but highly personal jealousy of the objects of the idolatrous feeling by which it was roused to an avenging rage. In a word, with passion. We may call it a primitive survival, if we will. The fact remains that only in passion does the turbulent word of the living God rightly test and fulfill itself. After we have heard the whole story, we shall realize that Joseph, however much his weakness injured him, possessed more understanding for this livingness of God, and knew better how to take skillful cognizance of it than his father who begot him. Of Rachel's distraction. Little Rachel, of course, knew nothing of all this. She hung on Jacob's neck and said to him, "Give me children, else I die." He answered, "Little pigeon, of what avail is all this? For thine impatience maketh thy husband likewise to feel impatient, and I should not have thought that I could ever have such a feeling against thee in my heart. Truly, it hath no reason that thou shouldst hang about me with prayers and tears. Am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of thy womb?" He put it off on God, by way of saying that the fault was not his, and that he had given ample evidence that he was not to blame. For was he not fruitful in Leah? To advise the younger sister to turn her prayers to God was the same as to say that the trouble lay at her door, in which, as in the vibration of his voice, he betrayed his impatience. It was natural that he should be irritated, for it was silly of Rachel to implore him for something for which he himself felt equal longing, without making his disappointed hopes a reproach to her. Still, one must needs make excuses for the poor child, for if she remained barren, she had the worse end of it. She was friendliness itself, but it was more than her woman's nature could bear and not feel jealous of her sister, and envy is a solvent to the emotions in which much else besides admiration unfortunately comes to the surface, and the reaction simply cannot be the best in the world. It could not but undermine the sisterly feeling between the two. In fact, it already did so. Leah's maternal status outweighed the advantage of her infertile co-wife, whose appearance was so much that of a virgin that the other must have been a hypocrite to be able to betray in her manner no trace of any consciousness of her superior worth. In the accepted and thoughtless phrase, the wife who had blessed her husband with children was the beloved, the other the unloved wife, a terminology hateful to Rachel's ears, and utterly false to boot. It was only human that she could not be content with the fact, but must bring it to speech and utter it. It unfortunately came to this, that she would refer with flashing eyes and paling cheek to Jacob's never-concealed preference and his more frequent visits at night. A sore point with Leah, of course, who, when it was touched upon, could only answer with a shrug that at least they did her no good. Thus, sisterly tenderness was at an end, and Jacob stood embarrassed between the two. Laban looked gloomily on. He rejoiced that the daughter whom Jacob had scorned should now come to honor, but he suffered for Rachel, and also he began to fear for his shekels. The lawgiver had set down in writing that if one wife went childless, the father-in-law must return the money, for such a marriage was only a mistake. Laban hoped that Jacob had not understood this, but he might learn it any day, and when there was no more hope for Rachel, Laban or his sons might be faced with the prospect of paying Jacob in cash for his 7 years' service. The thought lay heavy in Laban's belly. Therefore, when in the 3rd year of her marriage Leah was again expectant, being big this time with the boy Levi, and on Rachel's side there was no stirring whatever, it was Laban who came forward with the suggestion that there were certain measures which might be taken. In fact, he demanded that something be done, and introduced into the conversation the name of Bilhah, saying that Jacob might lie with her, and that she might bear upon Rachel's knees. It would be a mistake to suppose that Rachel had suggested, much less advocated, this, after all, rather obvious resource. Her feelings with regard to it were much too mixed for her to do more than simply acquiesce. But it is true that she was on close and friendly terms with Bilhah, her maid, an attractive little thing, before whose charms Leah had later to abandon the field entirely, and her craving to possess the dignity of motherhood drove out all the natural disinclination she must have felt for acting as once her stern father had acted, and introducing with her own hands a substitute into Jacob's bed. Actually, the affair was done the other way round. She led Jacob by the hand to Bilhah, who had scented herself beyond all limits, and whose little head was swimming with bliss. Having given the child a sisterly kiss, and said to her, "Since it must be so, sweetheart, I am glad that it is thou. Be mother of thousands." The exaggeration was simply an expression of her wish that Bilhah might be receptive in her mistress's place, which the child straightway was, announcing the success of the maneuver to her mistress, that the latter might tell her husband and parents. Bilhah bore the increase of her body in the ensuing months with little less stateliness than Leah hers, and Rachel, who was full of tenderness for the child from now on, and often put her ear and her caressing hands to Bilhah's rounding form, could read in the eyes of all observers the increased respect which her sacrifice earned for her. Poor Rachel! Was she happy? By means of a recognized resource in such cases, she had, to a certain extent, weakened the force of the divine decree. But her yearning heart was confused by the fact that her merit was waxing in a stranger's body. It was a half-merit, a half-joy, a half-self-deception, sanctioned by tradition since needs must, but without flesh and blood confirmation in Rachel herself. The very children would be only half-real, the sons whom Bilhah would raise up to her and to the husband whom she so fruitlessly loved. Rachel's had been the pleasure, another's would be the pain. That was convenient, but it was a sham and an abomination as well. Not in her thoughts, for they consented to the law and the custom, but to her straightforward and valiant little heart. In these days she wore a bewildered smile. But she performed, piously and joyfully, all that was granted and prescribed for her to do. Bilhah gave birth upon her knees, as the custom demanded. She embraced her from behind with her arms, and hours long she shared in the labor, the shrieking and the groans, midwife and parturient in one. It was not an easy birth. Bilhah labored for a full 24 hours, and at the end, Rachel was almost as worn out as the mother after the flesh, and that was a gratification to her soul. Thus came into the world that scion of Jacob who was named Dan, only a few weeks after the birth of Leah's Levi, in the 3rd year of marriage. But in the 4th year, when Leah was delivered of him whom she named Judah, praise God, Bilhah and Rachel, with their united powers, presented to the husband their 2nd son, and called his name Naphtali, for it seemed to them that he would be a wrestler. Thus Rachel had, in the name of God, 2 sons, and after this there were, for the time, no more.